Part 2. 16. Braun Lamia slept fitfully just before dawn, and her dreams were filled with images and sounds from elsewhere, half-heard and little-understood conversations with Mayna Gladstone, a room that seemed to be floating in space, a movement of men and women along corridors where the walls whispered like a poorly tuned fat-line receiver. And underlying the feverish dreams and random images was the maddening sense that Johnny, her Johnny, was so close, so close. Lamia cried out in her sleep, but the noise was lost in the random echoes of the Sphinx's cooling stones and shifting sands. Lamia awoke suddenly, coming completely conscious as surely as a solid-state instrument switching on. Saul Weintraub had been supposed to be standing guard, but now he slept near the low door of the room where the group sheltered. His infant daughter, Rachel, slept between blankets on the floor next to him. Her rump was raised, face pressed against the blanket, a slight bubble of saliva on her lips. Lamia looked around. In the dim illumination from a low-wattage glow-globe and the faint daylight reflected down 4 meters of corridor, only one other of her fellow pilgrims was visible, a dark bundle on the stone floor. Martin Silenus lay there snoring. Lamia felt a surge of fear, as if she had been abandoned while sleeping. Silenus saw the baby. She realized that only the consul was missing. Attrition had eaten at the pilgrimage party of 7 adults and an infant. Hetmastine missing on the wind wagon crossing of the Sea of Grass. Lenar Hoyt killed the night before. Kassad missing later that night. The consul. Where was the consul? Braun Lamia looked around again, satisfied herself that the dark room held nothing but packs, blanket bundles, the sleeping poet, scholar, and child. And then she rose, found her father's automatic pistol amidst the tumble of blankets, felt in her pack for the neural stunner, and then slipped past Weintraub and the baby into the corridor beyond. It was morning, and so bright out that Lamia had to shield her eyes with her hand as she stepped from the Sphinx's stone steps onto the hard-packed trail which led away down the valley. The storm had passed. Hyperion skies were a deep, crystalline lapis lazuli, shot through with green. Hyperion star. A brilliant white point source just rising above the eastern cliff walls. Rock shadows blended with the outflung silhouettes of the time tombs across the valley floor. The jade tomb sparkled. Lamia could see the fresh drifts and dunes deposited by the storm, white and vermilion sands blending in sensuous curves and striations around stone. There was no evidence of their campsite the night before. The consul sat on a rock, 10 meters down the hill. He was gazing down the valley, and smoke spiraled upward from his pipe. Slipping the pistol in her pocket with the stunner, Lamia walked down the hill to him. "No sign of Colonel Kassad," said the consul, as she approached. He did not turn around. Lamia looked down the valley to where the crystal monolith stood. Its once gleaming surface was pocked and pitted. The upper 20 or 30 meters appeared to be missing, and debris still smoked at its base. The half-kilometer or so between the Sphinx and the monolith were scorched and cratered. "It looks as if he didn't leave without a fight," she said. The consul grunted. The pipe smoke made Lamia hungry. "I searched as far as the Shrike Palace, 2 clicks down the valley," said the consul. "The locus of the firefight seems to have been the monolith. There's still no sign of a ground-level opening to the thing, but there are enough holes farther up now so that you can see the honeycomb pattern which deep radar has always shown inside."
"But no sign of Kassad?"
"None.
Blood? Scorched bones?
A note saying that he'd be back after delivering his laundry?" "Nothing." Braun Lamia sighed and sat on a boulder near the consul's rock. The sun was warm on her skin. She squinted out toward the opening to the valley.
"Well, hell," she said. "What do we do next?"
The consul removed his pipe, frowned at it, and shook his head. I tried the comm log relay again this morning, but the ship is still penned in. He shook ashes out. Tried the emergency bands, too. But obviously we're not getting through. Either the ship isn't relaying, or people have orders not to respond.
Would you really leave?
The consul shrugged. He had changed from his diplomatic finery of the day before into a rough wool pullover tunic top, gray whipcord trousers and high boots. Having the ship here would give us, you, the option of leaving. I wish the others would consider going. After all, Mastine's missing. Hoyt and Cassad are gone. I'm not sure what to do next, a deep voice said.
We could try making breakfast.
Lamia turned to watch Saul come down the path. Rachel was in the infant carrier on the scholar's chest. Sunlight glinted on the older man's balding head. Not a bad idea, she said. Do we have enough provisions left?
Enough for breakfast, said Weintraub. Then a few more meals of cold food packed from the colonel's extra provisions bag. Then we'll be eating googlepeds and each other.
The consul attempted a smile, set the pipe back in his tunic pocket.
I suggest we walk back to Kronos Keep before we reach that point. We'd used up the freeze-dried foods from the Benares, but there were storerooms at the keep.
I'd be happy to, began Lamia, but was interrupted by a shout from inside the Sphinx. She was the first to reach the Sphinx, and she had the automatic pistol in her hand before she went through the entrance. The corridor was dark, the sleeping room darker, and it took a second for her to realize that no one was there.
Braun Lamia crouched, swinging the pistol toward the dark curve of corridor, even as Silenus's voice again shouted,
Hey, come here!
From somewhere out of sight. She looked over her shoulder as the consul came through the entrance.
Wait there, snapped Lamia, and moved quickly down the corridor,
staying against the wall, pistol extended, propulsion charge primed, safety off. She paused at the open doorway to the small room where Hoyt's body lay, crouched, swung around and in with weapon tracking. Martin Silenus looked up from where he crouched by the corpse. The fiber-plastic sheet they had used to cover the priest's body lay crumpled and lifted in Silenus's hand. He stared at Lamia, looked without interest at the gun, and gazed back at the body.
Do you believe this? He said softly.
Lamia lowered the weapon and came closer. Behind them, the consul peered in. Braun could hear Saul Weintraub in the corridor. The baby was crying.
My God, said Braun Lamia, and crouched next to the body of Father Lenar Hoyt.
The young priest's pain-ravaged features had been re-sculpted into the face of a man in his late 60s. High brow, long aristocratic nose, thin lips with a pleasant upturn at the corners. Sharp cheekbones, sharp ears under a fringe of gray hair, large eyes under lids as pale and thin as parchment. The consul crouched near them.
I've seen Hollows. It's Father Paul Duray.
Look, said Martin Silenus.
He lowered the sheet further, paused, and then rolled the corpse on its side. Two small cruciforms on this man's chest pulsed pinkly, just as Hoyt's had. But his back was bare. Saul stood by the door, hushing Rachel's cries with gentle bouncing and whispered syllables. When the infant was silent, he said,
I thought that the Bakura took 3 days to regenerate.
Martin Silenus sighed.
The Bakura have been resurrected by the cruciform parasites for more than 2 standard centuries. Perhaps it's easier the first time.
Is he? Began Lamia.
Alive?
Silenus took her hand.
Feel.
The man's chest rose and fell ever so slightly. The skin was warm to the touch. Heat from the cruciforms under the skin was palpable. Braun Lamia snatched her hand back. The thing that had been the corpse of Father Lenar Hoyt 6 hours earlier opened its eyes.
Father Duray,
said Saul, stepping forward. The man's head turned. He blinked, as though the dim light hurt his eyes, then made an unintelligible noise.
Water,
said the consul, and reached into his tunic pocket for the small plastic bottle he carried. Martin Silenus held the man's head while the consul helped him drink. Saul came closer, went to one knee, and touched the man's forearm. Even Rachel's dark eyes seemed curious. Saul said,
"If you can't speak, blink twice for yes, once for no. Are you Dure?"
The man's head swiveled toward the scholar.
"Yes,"
he said softly, his voice deep, tones cultured.
"I am Father Paul Dure."
Breakfast consisted of the last cup of coffee, bits of meat fried over the unfolded heating unit, a scoop of grain mix with rehydrated milk, and the end of their last loaf of bread, torn into 5 chunks. Lamia thought that it was delicious. They sat at the edge of shade under the Sphinx's outflung wing, using a low, flat-topped boulder as their table. The sun climbed toward mid-morning, and the sky remained cloudless. There was no sound except for the occasional clink of a fork or spoon and the soft tones of their conversation.
"You remember before?"
asked Saul. The priest wore an extra set of the consul's ship clothes, a gray jumpsuit with the hegemony seal on the left breast. The uniform was a bit too small. Dore held the cup of coffee in both hands, as if he were about to lift it for consecration. He looked up, and his eyes suggested depths of intelligence and sadness in equal measure.
"Before I died?" said Dore.
The patrician lips sketched a smile.
"Yes, I remember. I remember the exile, the Bakura." He looked down. "Even the Tesla tree."
"Hoyt told us about the tree," said Braun Lamia. The priest had nailed himself onto an active Tesla tree in the flame forests, suffering years of agony, death, resurrection, and death again, rather than give in to the easy symbiosis of life under the cruciform. Dure shook his head.
"I thought, in those last seconds, that I had beaten it."
"You had," said the consul.
"Father Hoyt and the others found you. You had driven the thing out of your body. Then the Bakura planted your cruciform on Lenar Hoyt."
Dure nodded.
"And there is no sign of the boy."
Martin Silenus pointed toward the man's chest.
"Evidently the fucking thing can't defy laws governing conservation of mass. Hoyt's pain had been so great for so long, he wouldn't return to where the thing wanted him to go, that he never gained the weight for a, what the hell would you call it, a double resurrection."
"It doesn't matter," said Dure.
His smile was sad.
"The DNA parasite in the cruciform has infinite patience. It will reconstitute one host for generations if need be. Sooner or later, both parasites will have a home."
"Do you remember anything after the Tesla tree?" asked Saul quietly. Dure sipped the last of his coffee.
"Of death? Of heaven or hell?"
The smile was genuine.
"No, gentlemen and lady. I wish I could say I did. I remember pain. Eternities of pain. And then release. And then darkness. And then awakening here. How many years did you say have passed?"
"Almost 12, said the consul. "But only about half that for Father Hoyt. He spent time in transit." Father Dure stood, stretched, and paced back and forth. He was a tall man, thin but with a sense of strength about him, and Braun Lamia found herself impressed by his presence, by that strange, inexplicable charisma of personality which had cursed and bestowed power upon a few individuals since time immemorial. She had to remind herself that first, he was a priest of a cult that demanded celibacy from its clerics, and second, an hour earlier, he had been a corpse. Lamia watched the older man pace up and down, his movements as elegant and relaxed as a cat's, and she realized that both observations were true, but neither could counteract the personal magnetism the priest radiated. She wondered if the men sensed it. Dure sat on a boulder, stretched his legs straight ahead of him, and rubbed at his thighs as if trying to get rid of a cramp.
"You've told me something about who you are, why you are here," he said. "Can you tell me more?"
The pilgrims glanced at one another. Dure nodded.
"Do you think that I'm a monster myself? Some agent of the Shrike? I wouldn't blame you if you did.
We don't think that, said Braun Lamia. The Shrike needs no agents to do his bidding. Besides, we know you from Father Hoyt's story about you and from your journals. She glanced at the others. We found it difficult to tell our stories of why we have come to Hyperion. It would be all but impossible to repeat them.
I made notes on my comm log, said the consul. They're very condensed, but it should make some sense out of our histories. And the history of the last decade of the hegemony. Why the Web is at war with the Ousters. That sort of thing. You're welcome to access it if you wish. It shouldn't take more than an hour.
I would appreciate it, said Father Duray, and followed the consul back into the Sphinx.
Braun Lamia, Saul, and Silenus walked to the head of the valley. From the saddle between the low cliffs, they could see the dunes and barrens stretching toward the mountains of the Bridal Range, less than 10 clicks to the southwest. The broken globes, soft spires, and shattered gallerias of the dead City of Poets were visible only 2 or 3 clicks to their right, along a broad ridge which the desert was quietly invading.
I'll walk back to the keep and find some rations, said Lamia.
I hate to split up the group, said Saul. We could all return.
Martin Silenus folded his arms.
Somebody should stay here in case the colonel returns.
Before anyone leaves, said Saul, I think we should search the rest of the valley. The consul didn't check far beyond the monolith this morning.
I agree, said Lamia. Let's get to it before it gets too late. I want to get provisions at the keep and return before nightfall.
They had descended to the Sphinx when Duray and the consul emerged. The priest held the consul's spare comm log in one hand. Lamia explained the plan for a search, and the two men agreed to join them. Once again they walked the halls of the Sphinx, the beams from their hand torches and pencil lasers illuminating sweating stone and bizarre angles. Emerging into noontime sunlight, they made the 300-meter hike to the Jade Tomb. Lamia found herself shivering as they entered the room where the Shrike had appeared the night before. Hoyt's blood had left a rust-brown stain on the green ceramic floors. There was no sign of the transparent opening to the labyrinth below. There was no sign of the Shrike. The obelisk had no rooms, merely a central shaft in which a spiral ramp, too steep for human comfort, twisted upward between ebony walls. Even whispers echoed here, and the group kept talk to a minimum. There were no windows, no view at the top of the ramp, 50 meters above the stone floor, and their torch beams illuminated only blackness as the roof curved in above them. Fixed ropes and chains left over from 2 centuries of tourism allowed them to descend without undue fear of a slip and fall that would end in death below. As they paused at the entrance, Martin Silenus called Kassad's name a final time, and the echoes followed them into sunlight. They spent half an hour or more inspecting the damage near the crystal monolith. Puddles of sand turned to glass, some 5 to 10 meters across, prismed the noonday light and reflected heat in their faces. The broken face of the monolith, pocked now with holes and still dangling strands of melted crystal, looked like the target of an act of mindless vandalism. But each knew that Kassad must have been fighting for his life. There was no door, no opening to the honeycomb maze within. Instruments told them that the interior was as empty and unconnected as it always had been. They left reluctantly, climbing the steep trails to the base of the north cliffs, where the cave tombs lay separated by less than 100 meters each.
Early archaeologists thought that these were the oldest of the tombs, because of their crudeness, said Saul as they entered the first cave, sent flashlight beams playing across stone, carved in 1,000 indecipherable patterns. None of the caves was deeper than 30 or 40 meters. Each ended in a stone wall that no amount of probing or radar imaging had ever discovered an extension to. Upon exiting the 3rd cave tomb, the group sat in what little shade they could find, and shared water and protein biscuits from Kassad's extra field rations. The wind had risen, and now it sighed and whispered through fluted rock high above them.
"We're not going to find him," said Martin Silenus. "The fucking Shrike took him."
Saul was feeding the baby with one of the last nursing packs. The top of her head had been turned pink by the sun, despite Saul's every effort to shield her as they walked outside.
"He could be in one of the tombs we were in," he said, "if there are sections out of time phase with us. That's Arendez's theory. He sees the tombs as four-dimensional constructs, with intricate folds through space-time."
"Great," said Lamia.
"So even if Fedman Kassad is there, we won't see him."
"Well," said the consul, getting to his feet with a tired sigh, "let's at least go through the motions. One tomb left."
The Shrike Palace was a kilometer farther down the valley, lower than the others and hidden by a bend in the cliff walls. The structure was not large, smaller than the Jade Tomb, but its intricate construction, flanges, spires, buttresses, and support columns, arching and arcing in controlled chaos, made it seem larger than it was. The interior of the Shrike Palace was one echoing chamber, with an irregular floor made up of thousands of curving, jointed segments, which reminded Lamia of the ribs and vertebrae of some fossilized creature. 15 meters overhead, the dome was crisscrossed by dozens of the chrome blades, which continued through walls and each other to emerge as steel-tipped thorns above the structure. The material of the dome itself was slightly opaque, giving a rich, milky hue to the vaulted space. Lamia, Silenus, the consul, Weintraub, and Duray all began to shout for Kassad, their voices echoing and resonating to no avail.
"No sign of Kassad or Hetmastin," said the consul as they emerged. "Perhaps this will be the pattern, each of us disappearing until only one remains. And does that final one get his or her wish, as the Shrike cult legends foretell?"
asked Braun Lamia. She sat on the rocky hearth to the Shrike palace, her short legs dangling in the air. Paul Duray raised his face to the sky.
"I can't believe that it was Father Hoyt's wish that he would die, so that I could live again."
Martin Silenus squinted up at the priest.
"So what would your wish be, Padre?"
Duray did not hesitate.
"I would wish, pray, that God will lift the scourge of these twin obscenities, the war and the Shrike, from mankind once and for all."
There was a silence, in which the early afternoon wind inserted its distant sighs and moans.
"In the meantime," said Braun Lamia, "we've got to get some food, or learn how to subsist on air."
Duray nodded.
"Why did you bring so little with you?"
Martin Silenus laughed and said loudly,
"Ne cared he for wine or half and half, ne cared he for fish or flesh or fowl, and sauces held he worthless as the chaff. He's deigned the swineherd at the wassail bowl. Ne with lewd ribald sat he cheek by jowl, ne with sly lemans in the scorner's chair. But after water brooks this pilgrim soul panted, and all his food was woodland air, though he would oft-times feast on gillyflowers rare."
Duray smiled, obviously still puzzled.
"We all expected to triumph or die the first night," said the consul. "We hadn't anticipated a long stay here."
Braun Lamia stood and brushed off her trousers. "I'm going," she said. "I should be able to carry back 4 or 5 days' rations if they're field food packs or the bulk stored items we saw."
"I'll go too," said Martin Silenus.
There was a silence. During the week of their pilgrimage, the poet and Lamia had almost come to blows 6 times. Once she had threatened to kill the man. She looked at him for a long moment. "All right," she said at last. "Let's stop by the Sphinx to get our packs and water bottles." The group moved up the valley as the shadows began to grow from the western walls.